Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Webb, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host, still germ-free and here to record, Mr. Spencer Williams.
Thanks.
I mean, it's a good thing that you're germ-free, right? Because then we're still able to, you know, do the show.
Well, that's the thing about the virus is nobody knows. It's like a killer in a really bad, scary movie.
You do know this virus is killing people, right?
Yes.
Okay, just saying. We got a great show in store for you, for all those people who are home and just looking for something.
Pretty much all of us.
Which is pretty much all of us. We are all, we are in Studio B as producer Corey and his wife are currently expecting a child on the way, and so
that's awesome.
Which is great, wonderful, absolutely fantastic, but it does put us in a bind because we can't record there, so screw them. No. We love them. We hope nothing but the best and just all cleanliness and everything else for them and well wishes. So, but we are talking about Parasite, and we are excited to talk about this Oscar winner. So before we do, Spencer, give him a little bit of that opening info.
Because it sounded like you skipped over a Prius.
No, what do we usually open
okay,
with?
Okay, I'm just double checking. So each and every Wednesday, we are here because we are stuck in our houses.
That is true.
So you can find us on all your favorite streaming platforms and on our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also connect with us on our social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We got over 200 episodes on our website. You can check us out, listen to us there, or listen to us on your favorite podcast streaming app, on your phone, on your desktop, anywhere you go, we are there. Like, okay. Speaking of virus, we are talking about the film that took the world by storm, debuting at the Cannes Film Festival, and ultimately just wowing fans worldwide. And that is 2019's Parasite. So this film was completely unprecedented. Like it floored people at the Cannes Film Festival. It honestly wowed fans that were in South Korea. And when it made its way to the States, it was like this little secret that if you could find it, you could watch it and you could like endure it. And we'll talk about that in a second. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give him that synopsis goodness? Not the opening of the show.
Okay. So. All right. Meet the Park family, the picture of aspirational wealth, and the Kim family, rich in street smarts but not much else. Be it chance or fate, these two houses are brought together, and the Kims sense a golden opportunity. Masterminded by the college-age Ki Woo, the Kim children expediently install themselves as a tutor and an art therapist to the Parks. Soon, a symbiotic relationship forms between these two families. The Kims provide indispensable luxury services while the Parks obliviously bankroll their entire household. When a parasitic interloper threatens the Kims' newfound comfort, a savage, underhanded battle for dominance breaks out, threatening to destroy the fragile ecosystems between the Kims and the Parks.
Directed by Bong Joon-ho, the film stars Song Kang-ho, Lee Sun-kyun, Cho Yeo-jung, Choi Woo-shik, Park So-dam, Jang Hee-jin, and Lee Jung-yoon. I'm actually a big fan of Lee Sun-kyun because he actually was in a... He does a lot of Korean drama shows, and there's one in particular that he does that I actually really, really like. It's called Pasta. He plays a chef. It's great. He actually, his name in there is chef. But either way, I'm a big fan of a lot of the people in this. Bong Joon-ho has also been well known for a lot of other films. He's the director who did Snowpiercer. So he's done a lot of great films in the past. And this is another one that you can chalk up to the whole, like, you need to see it. Because this film is absolutely incredible. The film won the Palme d'Or at the 2019 Cannes Film Festival, the first Korean film to ever do so. It also won the first non-English film. It became the first non-English film to win the Best Picture Oscar Award. In an interview with Korean magazine Cine 21, director Bong Joon-ho spoke of his experience in filming in a hyper-rich Korean home. He said his hand literally shook from anxiety when he was returning a trash can that was used as a prop. The trash can was of a high-tech variety that stayed silent even when the lid was being closed and cost as much as $2,500. Yeah. That is insane.
No. I would be so terrified. They're like, what's this red stuff on our trash can?
I was worried when producer Corey got that one trash can put into his house and you wave your hand over it and the lid popped open and you could throw stuff in there and it'll close by itself. I was worried about that. And that one was like $100. Like,
are you worried about that? You don't even have to touch it.
Because I have a tendency to break things.
Don't touch it.
That's hard because I have to touch it. Like, ooh, shiny. But for a trash can that's $2,500, I'd be worried. And I did say it was one of those hidden gems because when it made its way over to the U.S., it only opened in 3 theaters.
Mm.
So its budget for the film was about 13.5 billion won, which translates to about $11 million U.S. Its opening weekend in South Korea was on the 30th of May in 2019, and it opened to $20.7 million U.S. Worldwide, the film came about $266 million for its entire lifespan in the theaters. Now, when it made its way over here, it came out a few months after the South Korea, you know, release, and it actually opened only in, I want to say, three or four theaters between L.A. and New York. So because of that, the ratio to the amount of ticket sales compared to the amount of theaters that actually held it, for it being an international film, it actually an international specialty film, it actually broke records. So it's pretty crazy. And this particular film is such a unique it's almost like, I almost want to call it like a work of art, because when you watch these types of movies, usually like there's social commentary here and there, there's little things here and there. And it was something you said a little bit earlier while we were talking that actually kind of struck a chord. Like, you were talking about how you don't realize until...
Oh, yeah. Like, this movie is so subtle in the way it works is that you don't realize till, like, you're a little bit in how deep the movie actually is.
Yeah.
There's, like, a lot of, like, surfacey level stuff that looks like it's not deep, but it actually really is.
Yeah. And there's so much subtext. There's so much commentary. And so we're going to talk about this film. We're going to review it, and we're just going to really dive deep into the subtext of a lot of what this film is saying. So, warning out there, obviously, if you haven't seen it, you should see it, or you should have seen it, but spoiler alert, we're just going to kind of go all into it and talk about this unique and quite interesting film. So, expectations, sorry, seeing as I saw it in theaters, you saw it after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first impression you had going into, like, getting ready to see the film?
Your
expectations?
Really, the only thing I knew was that it had just won all the awards, like, during award season.
You're like, it has to be a good one. Everybody picked it.
Actually, no. It's like, sometimes I don't trust that. But in this case, it kind of did.
I think we're starting to slowly learn, Spencer, that you don't trust a lot of things.
Yeah, I don't. Like, yeah. So I was actually really excited to see this movie because I can't really think of any South Korean movies I've watched.
Yeah.
So I was really interested in seeing what that would be like.
Well, for me, and I was thinking about it, actually, I
did. So did you see it in theaters before?
No. I didn't see it in theaters. Oh, okay. I actually bought it right like in January before the Oscars because I wanted to see it and see what was all the fuss about. Everybody had talked about it. Everybody raved about it, ranted about it. A lot of the people that we know that's in L.A., they were going nuts over it. Like, oh, you know, Parasite's the best thing ever since, you know, Marty McFly and Doc had a kid. You know, things like that. I don't know.
Okay. Like, just... I don't know what kind of fan fiction you're watching. You need to stop.
No, but they were talking about how this film was like a great work of art. Uh-huh. And I absolutely had to see it. And unfortunately, by the time I got around to hearing about it, but realizing that I needed to see it, it was already out of the theaters. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, the digital version of it immediately became available online, and I swooped it up and saw it. So it was great, and to be able to find it. So my honest first impression, or my expectations, I keep getting those mixed up. I just want to keep moving forward. My expectations were, I didn't know that one actor, Lee Soon Kyun, I didn't know he was in this. Mm-hmm. All I knew was that it looked like a horror film, but then I heard there was comedy in it, or I heard there was, it wasn't a horror, if you look at the cover of the poster,
looks like a horror film.
Yeah, it looks straight up like a horror film. I'm like, oh my gosh. And my mind went immediately to, please don't let this be as bad as Grudge. Please don't let this be as bad as Grudge. Because in my mind, I'm like, okay, this is a horror film. All right, Parasite maybe has to do with one of the films that I remember, and I don't know if it was him who did it, but the director, I don't know if Bong Joon-ho did it, but I immediately thought of, he did do it. He wrote it. The Host. I don't know if you ever saw The Host, but The Host is a movie essentially about, he directed it too. It's about a monster that emerges in South Korea out of the river, and it begins attacking people, and it takes away this family's, little sister, the little sister, the daughter, and they go and they, go and rescue. Oddly enough, the guy who plays the father to the lower class family, he plays the eldest son in that one.
Oh.
So it's really interesting. A great film. And I honestly thought, because they were from the same director, I'm like, oh, this looks like it's just like The Host. And I knew he had done Snowpiercer, so I knew he could do social commentary. I didn't know there was any kind of social commentary in this movie. So I from what everybody said, which most people didn't say much to me because they didn't want to ruin it, but they were like, it's a great movie, it's an interesting movie, it'll scare you, it'll this. And I'm like, what's the horror aspect? What am I looking forward to? So knowing he did both of those films prior to, I was anxious. I was like, I don't know what I'm getting myself into. Is this going to be like some kind of weird cult movie? Like, I'm not about to dive into another Midsummer. Like, I can't handle that right now. I got to do like only one or two of those a year, and Hereditary and Midsummer seem to come out around the same time. So I'm good. So I didn't know what to expect in terms of expectations. All I knew is that he had created two really great films that were kind of political in terms of their commentary, whether if it's about the pollution and the Mao taking care of the waters and whatnot in South Korea, or it's about the social commentary of how the haves and the have-nots, are divided in this definitive line and so forth in this fight for truth and understanding, Snowpiercer. And so I only took into account the fact that he hasn't failed me yet. So I just, and if everybody's talking about it, it has to be a good movie.
Well, everyone could be talking about a bad movie.
I know. And I was hoping for the best. I was like, I cannot stand, if everybody... To be quite honest, I fall so easily for the overhype test. Like, people are like, oh, you got to check this out. Oh, it's the greatest thing ever. It's blah, blah, blah. And more than most times, it has failed me. Like, to be honest, I fall for it. And it's like, I know my expectations are just way too high for this movie, but I just really hope it works, because they all said it was like so wonderful, and I get out hating myself. A similar fashion, there's when I came over, we're getting ready to record, your roommates actually were getting ready to watch the Netflix documentary, The Tiger King.
Yeah.
And I had heard so much about that documentary, and same thing. I was like, we mentioned this on the last episode on What You're Watching, Quarantine Edition, the last episode. I mentioned, okay, I'm going to see this because I really want to see it. Everyone's talking about it. And I'm like, if this is the dumbest thing since, you know, The Amazing Bulk, if I'm watching this on Netflix, and I swear it is like, it's a whole Rickroll thing.
Okay, but like the thing is, you can turn it off.
You can't, because it's like you're it's like you just can't, really. You just can't. It's like eating like a really big piece of cake. You're already going in halfway. You might as well finish it.
No, I would recommend you not do that.
But then if you don't, the chocolate gets hard on the frosting, and it's not really worth watch or eating. And it's not real. I mean, then you just waste a whole half a cake, you know, and then you don't have anybody to share it with, and nobody wants to eat day old cake, you know. Especially if you've eaten half.
What are you doing with cake?
I'm hungry, okay? So, either way. But, side note, I saw that documentary. It's nuts. It's addicting. And you're going to totally find yourself wishing you could go and save a rain. I immediately, after I saw that documentary, looked up online and donated to the rainforest. No joke. I sent $20 to somebody to go and help fix the rainforest. I'm not even going to lie. Fix the tigers. Help them out. Give them a lift to home. I don't know. But either way, those were my expectations. There wasn't much, and I wasn't too sure. And honestly, I'm going to be like completely transparent. I wasn't sure what I was going to get into. Mm-hmm. Plain and simple. I heard little to nothing about the film in terms of plot. All I knew was it was a good movie. It had to do with the film, something about the one of the actresses who kept like using her finger to like make notes for like do 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 do, like when she's repeating her name at the door.
Mm-hmm. Oh right, okay.
All I knew is that people were hounding her to keep doing that over and over, like airports and all that. It was weird. So yeah, I wasn't too sure what to expect. I was just really hoping for good things.
Okay.
So after watching it. First impressions after you finally watched it.
Wait, I stopped 20 minutes into the movie. I was like, this movie is out of control in the best way. I'm only 20 minutes into it. I was so happy about this movie, like just even 20 minutes into it. And by the time I got to the end of the movie, I was like, this is fantastic. Just absolutely fantastic from beginning to end.
Really?
Yeah. No, I love this movie.
This movie had me delving into so many perspectives of like my filmography and my mind in the filmography and my mindset, like all the things that I had in mind, all the movies that I was using in comparison. It felt wrong to draw like from other films, like, okay, well, they probably got that from this. Well, they probably drew inspiration from that. This film worked so well in giving homage to several other entities out there in the cinematic world, and yet still kept you focused on what the families were going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like this slow downward spiral into madness, but it was like, it was a ballerina who was like slowly yet gracefully falling into this meat grinder as she's pirouetting into the grinding stones, turning her into like goop and red pulp. Like
that's the weirdest thing for you to have said, but it makes so much sense.
It's true.
It really is true.
And then like at the very end of the, like at the end of that pirouette, like her head pops and you're like, oh my gosh, was that supposed to happen? Like, but you've been seeing this slow spiral all the way the entire time. And so this movie does so many unique things, and we're going to talk about it because I really want to dig into it. And so one more time, just to let you know, spoiler alert, we will be talking about spoilers. This movie really derives a lot of inspiration from many other social commentary pieces. And I say that with all earnest because I've seen a good portion of them, but one of them that really stood out to me the most, I really have to admit it, was a German film way back when I first started watching silent films. This was one of those ones that I fell in love with immediately. And it's a 1927 film, and I know you haven't seen it, but it's I believe it's a German film done back in the in 1927 called Metropolis. And Metropolis is by far one of the oldest and yet telling and like informative films in terms of social commentary and the definitive line that we create as a society between the haves and the have-nots. And it's a beautiful story. It's essentially a film about a futuristic city that's divided between the working class and the people who are called the city planners. But they're essentially, the way it works, everybody who lives in the city, they live off of the world. They live lavishly. They frolic in the garden. They eat fruit and they do all these other stuff. And they're able to do all this stuff while all the people who are workers work underground, and they turn the wheels and they work the machines, and they do everything that allows everything above to stay working. Side note, if you've ever seen that episode of Futurama where Bender and everyone else help the mutants revolt against the people from above, same concept. It's the same thing. That's where that's all like derived from, inspired from, Metropolis, not Futurama. So, but the definitive like difference between the people who live above and the people who, you know, have all these lavish luxuries and $2,500 trash cans, you know, and the distinctive difference between them and the people who struggle, excuse me, every day, it's like, man, there's like a very distinct difference between the two. And I think it's so evident in the film. What do you think?
You're talking about how the difference between the haves and have-nots?
In the film, yeah.
Well, so this movie opens up with, like, the Kim family. I am just super intrigued with their backstory. because it shows them like just living in like this like basement type apartment, and they were just so ready to integrate themselves into this family that I'm like, how did they get that good type stuff? Like, is that part of like a saying of like, you know, the have nots have to be like more on the edge of like, you know, how can we take advantage of any type of situation and turn it for ourselves type thing? Or
I think what it does, what this film does, is it easily identifies for this type of situation that people who are at a disadvantage, because to be quite honest, there are several arguments for this case. Like, you could say easily that, well, they don't have because they don't try, or they don't, you know, do whatever or whatnot. But then there's also the argument as well that say, oh, well, they also don't have because of the way the government works and the way like opportunities work here, and you're looked down upon if you're not like living in the right neighborhood, or if you're not in the right, you know, if you don't work in the right industry, or you don't have the right clothes. What those opening scenes do establish is ultimately the father is willing to risk just about anything to save a penny. Like, he actually allows them to leave the windows open when they're spraying pesticide outside. So that way they could do a free extermination of any of the bugs that are in the house. And they're like literally they're folding pizza boxes while this like chemical is being sprayed all over, and the rest of the family is like coughing up a storm, and he's just sitting there and still folding.
Yeah. He's sitting there watching a tutorial video on how to do a fold properly.
Yeah. And even so, like, they're folding pizza boxes for a small pizza company, and they try to weasel their way into, which it again, early on in the film, establishes that their cunning, you know, abilities are used to weasel their way into situations that will help them gain more opportunities for money. Now, it's never stated that they do try to cut corners here and there with their work, but it doesn't say that they're not willing to do the work.
Right.
Which is very something you have to take notice of. They're willing to do the work. You know, they're willing to fold the boxes all sitting there, or they're willing to, you know, allow themselves to get sprayed with pesticide, or, you know, or help them deliver the pizzas and get paid for it. But their negotiation skills are on par with that of Winston Churchill, because they are able to convince this woman who is literally on the brink of firing them to not only hire them to do the pizza deliveries, but also to keep them on and not fire them, you know?
Yeah.
And so it transitions over to, like, the oldest son, the oldest child of the son, goes and meets with a friend who is going away to college or to university in America, and wants him to take over tutoring that he was doing with this young girl in this rich house. And because the boy had taken the exam to get into university so many times, but seemed to have failed every time, he knew the material well enough that he could teach her. And as a gift for that, he gives them what's known as a scholar's stone, which is very interesting, because I was looking it up and I'm like, one of the key like pieces that is consistent throughout this film, it's almost like the bridge, if you will, is that stone. Because like at one point in time, they're like, what are we going to do with this? And it's picked up and it's put back down. But it's that whole action was done to remind you, hey, this is still here. So it's very interesting that is a part of the story thread of this film. And maybe as we talk more, we'll figure out why. But and this kind of steamrolls into, not only does the kid go and begin tutoring, he goes and interviews with the mom, shows the girl, you know, that he knows what he's, you know, what he knows, and he knows how to do it well, becomes their tutor, and then essentially begins to work his way into recommending the rest of his family, not as his family, but as other people. Like, oh, I know a woman. She's from America. She, you know, she was living in America, did art, blah, blah, blah. She's an art therapist, or blah, 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 blah. I can bring her in so that you can, you know, interview her for your son, because he likes to draw, apparently. And it steamrolls from the sister to the father to the mother. And they all end up working in the same house. And the chaos that ensues in this film, like the things that this family does, the first two, the son and the daughter, there wasn't any kind of like underhandedness. But then when you
talk about the sister though.
Oh, no. What she does some underhanded stuff. Yeah. Yes. Yes. But what I'm saying is, prior to them, like them getting into those positions, like the son, he actually did all the studying, and that's why he's got that position.
Right.
And then the daughter, she just looked up some stuff.
She was Googling words to basically say to the mother. That's what she was doing.
She was right on the money, though, and it was like a really great guess. She's like, what happened to him in the third grade or when he was whatever? And she's like, oh. She's like, how do you know about that?
Basically, she was pulling, what was that guy? John Edwards, the crossing over guy.
Oh, my gosh.
That's what she was doing. She was basically reading.
What was the name of that one that one psychic that looked like a blob? with hair.
Oh, the one from Montel Williams, Sylvia Brown or something like that?
Oh my gosh. I'm glad you knew who I was talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know why I brought that up, but it just... and she weaseled her way in there, but like in terms of like underhandedness to other people, that's when things start like taking a turn for like how devious and ruthless, I guess you could say, this family begins to show their true colors. Because the daughter, they end up offering the daughter a ride home, and so she has the driver drive her to the bus station or the train station, and she leaves her underwear in like the front pocket of the chair in front of her. And it turns into like this whole game of like well-placed dominoes where that ends up getting the driver fired and they have to get a new driver. And so the dad, who had at one point in time did driving like for somebody or something, ends up getting recommended by the daughter. And then it takes like a really bad turn because they intentionally make the housekeeper, who had been with the family all the way through the entirety of them living in that house and the previous family as well that was living in the house who had passed away, they force her to have an allergic reaction to peaches, which was so bad.
Oh yeah, that was not okay in the slightest.
And for you, for somebody who's like allergic, who gets allergic to things, I'm like, that would be horrible if somebody at your job was just like, hey, Spence, let me rub this puppy in your face and see what
you're doing. Is they were shaving peaches and then just like walking by her and throwing it in the air. And like she had such a violent reaction to that. I was like, these people are jerks.
Yeah. And then they say it's something else. It's not like it's not an allergic reaction. They say it's like,
oh, say it's TB.
TB. Yeah. And they're like, oh, it's deathly, you know, contagious, and, you know, your son and blah, blah, blah. And essentially, the woman gets fired.
Okay, but the whole sequence of getting her fired was such a masterclass in like
in underhanded, like, scheming, you know, ruthlessness of like family camaraderie. It's like what you would expect out of like a family of thieves to do when they want to go on an outing. Like, hey, let's go get somebody fired. Okay, like this is like. And it's orchestrated so well that everybody is in on it, because everybody's got like little pouches of peach fuzz in their pockets or in their hands. It's like, oh my gosh, these people are gonna kill her.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm surprised she didn't die from the peaches thing.
Did you see her face?
Yeah.
They made her face look so puffed up and red. I'm like, oh my gosh, they killed her. Like, they could have. But they end up getting her kicked out and fired because of her TB, quote unquote, and they recommend the wife or the mother, which is really unique because they have the funds to get another line in the house, another phone to answer, so that they could pretend to be like a premier service.
Yeah.
So that the mother can get hired on as the housekeeper, so that everybody can live in the house, or everyone can reside in the house and get paid consistently. It's oh my gosh, it's so strange. And at this point, it seems almost like Chris Columbus-esque. This is very Home Alone. This is very like, you almost expect like some kind of, you know, some kind of detective or something to come in and be like, uh-huh, it's you or whatever. I don't know, like Detective Perrault. That's from Murder on the Orient Express, for those who don't know.
Very good.
But it then transitions into like a stopping point for where these people are at with the lives that they're involved in. You begin to realize like the Parks are the ones who live there, right?
Yes.
The Parks are oblivious to any of this, and they're fine and they're happy and nothing is bothering them. The Kims, however, are like on this constant alert of like being aware of where, of how far they can take their scheme, because after a certain point, the luxury and the money and the food and the lavish you know, living is honestly not theirs, and it's not theirs to have. There's a really great scene where all of them are sitting in the living room because the family has gone off to go camping. The youngest son's birthday was imminent, and usually what they do is they go camping to take him away and just kind of have a little fun away from the house for the weekend. And so they're all sitting down, and they are drinking everything that is in that house. And then they come to find out that the original housekeeper, who is still red and puffy and everything, is like banging on the door, and she's like, "I need to get in. I left something. It's in the basement. I need, you know, whatever." And the housekeeper has to keep up the ruse, so she lets her in, and she immediately runs downstairs, and she's down there for like a bit. And they finally go down there and realize that she's trying to move this huge cabinet. And so the housekeeper helps her move it, and you find that there's a hidden staircase. This whole thing turned Pan's Labyrinth all of a sudden, because you're like, where the heck does this lead? Narnia? Does it lead to, like, I don't know, you know, Arendelle? Are we going to meet the elves? You know, I you don't know where this is going. And it was at this point in the movie where I thought, okay, there's probably a ghost down there. Or there's a creature of some sort. The movie's called Parasite. Maybe this is where we're going to meet the parasite.
I'm on that board with you. Like, once the mom is going down the staircase,
I'm like, that's the last time we're seeing the mom.
I'm like, is she going to be killed off right now? Because, like, I have no idea where we're going at this point.
And you're at a loss because you're like, wait a second. So I thought, like, the whole social commentary thing, I thought the parasites were the family that's like mooching off of this other family.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, there's a demon dog downstairs. Like, you're actually expecting something really crazy to happen. And the family's like worried about the mom because she goes downstairs and they follow suit, or she goes down there. Come to find out, there's like this underground bunker. And the housekeeper, her and her husband had been living down there. And it's like, what? Like, what is this kind of, what is happening here? And apparently her husband had been like, had been in debt, like hardcore. People were looking for him. And the only safe place for him to be was to stay there. And so she would like sneak him food, or he would sneak out when it was quiet enough under her like discretion, you know, watching or whatever, and he would come out and grab some stuff, or she would bring him some food, and he's been without sustenance for a good amount of time. He hasn't seen her in a good amount of time, and so she's super worried. And so the rest of the family ends up like stumbling over because they're like all the way drunk. They've been drinking all night, and she's like, "Oh, you're a parasite too," and it's like, "Oh heck no, techno." It's like grudge match on the bottom underneath the house. She's like, you expletive, like, you know, how dare you tell me that, you know, you're going to call the cops on me when you guys are all family. You guys were in on it. You almost killed me. All this, this, and that. And you're like, this turned straight up Jerry Springer. Like, these people are about to duke it out. Like, I'm waiting for, what was his name? Steve? The big bouncer,
yeah.
Come out and Steve and come and separate people. But it turns into this whole fiasco because now the current family that's in there know the secret that the previous family was hiding, but the previous family knows the secret of the current family, and both of them cannot reside. Right. So it turns into like this crazy, like running around, going nuts. Like, you think you hear somebody kill somebody, and it's like, oh my gosh, there's so much happening right now. And at this point in the movie, I realized there's no creature downstairs. Because I had, the entire time I was watching this movie, I had the poster on my phone, and I'm like, there's a monster in this movie. I'm going to find it. And the poster just legitimately has the guy standing in the lawn, and And I'm not like, this is not something that I'm just making up. That's what the poster looks like. Like, see,
yeah.
there's a man standing alone and there's a body on the floor. What am I supposed to think? But it's interesting because even in the poster, you can distinctly see how the Kim family have the black bars on their eyes and the Park family have the white bars on their eyes.
I did not notice that.
Even in the poster, it definitively divides the two situations. And so everything comes to like this screeching and crazy halt as the family calls the housekeeper or calls the phone and says they got rained out. They're coming home. They're going to, you know, just come back home and, you know, lay down and go to sleep, whatever, which the family had been expecting. The other family to be gone for at least a couple of days.
Yeah.
So there's alcohol on the floor. There's been a fight between both families, the two parasitic families. And one of them has a phone that has footage of them being, you know, in the house. The other one is like trying to keep their like their rain on whatever drippings they can get from the table, you know, kind of thing. And this is where the film begins to start divulging the ruthlessness and the severity of what this whole thing turns into. Like, because you essentially have like this, the dad who thwacks the other housemaid so hard that she goes tumbling down the stairs.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa, like she dead. Yeah. Like it's not, there's no question about it. Like the husband who's still downstairs is trying to figure out what the heck's going on. He ends up getting tied up by one of them and they have to figure out how to make some thrown together dish for them by the time they get home. So that way, not only do they have to clean up all the alcohol, but they have to try to get out of the house because three of them shouldn't be in that house. The only person who should be in there is a housekeeper. And everything that follows suit after that begins to clearly divide like the three others when they finally get out of the house, when they finally sneak out. The film does a beautiful job. There's one scene where they're running down the street and they have to walk down this huge stairwell on the side of the road. And it almost creates this clear divide between where the ones that have and the ones that have not reside. Hmm. And this is where I got immediate imagery from Metropolis, 1927's Metropolis, because I'm like, oh my gosh, this is completely being inspired by Metropolis. This is all about, you know, what certain people have and how they have to fight for it and what other people have, what others have not, and they aspire for it. And it turns into this whole thing where the family, as they go back to their home, find out that their home flooded out. You know, they didn't close the window properly and the entire house is flooded, which makes me wonder. I'm like, how many times had that happened prior where they didn't have to worry about it flooding out? Like, it had to have flooded out before.
Yeah, I feel like that couldn't have just been a once in a while thing.
Yeah, there's no way that, what is that, fix it, seal it, whatever stuff that they have?
Oh, I don't remember what it's called right now, but yeah.
Yeah, like, I feel like they could have put some of that on the windows and made sure it not happen. But, needless to say, at that point in the film, it now sincerely identifies who are the have-nots, which are the people who are now residing in a gym with other people who've had their homes rained out, and gathering clothes from a large pile of donated, found, you know, stolen clothes or whatever, to have enough for them to dress well enough to go and finish their duties at the other house. And it's just, this movie begins to almost wretch, like create this wretched feeling within you. Cause you're like, oh my gosh, these are people that we may go to work with every day. These are the people that we may share a cup of coffee with while at well, No, we don't go to work anymore right now. So, but when we did go to work, these are the people that we would go to work with every day that we'd have, you know, share a cup of coffee with in the break room, you know, wave to as we leave from work to go to our cars. You know, these are the people that we may not be heavily invested into and could be going home to this every day. You know, just because they wear the nice clothes, they wear the suit, they wear the tie, they wear the dress shirt, that doesn't mean that it's like that's like regular attire when they get home, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it really kind of brings to light like how much of the world around us are we oblivious to? Like you and I, we're working off of like a $300 or $200 digital recorder. We got $200-something microphones. You got a couple $100 laptop right there. I got a $600 phone. Like we are living in an era of like lavish, luxurious lifestyle for where we are compared to those who completely and definitively don't. Mm-hmm. You know, and it just makes you like begin to think like, oh my gosh, like have we ever pushed off? Have I ever pushed off somebody or made somebody feel more aware of what they are lacking in within their life like that? Oh. Like, I know it's not like this wasn't, I don't know if this movie was meant to like create this a whole introspective mindset, but like when I was watching it, I immediately moved to the mindset of like, crap. Like there are scenes where they're hiding under the couch and they're waiting for the family to go to sleep so they can sneak out. And while they're waiting, the family, the husband and wife, they're talking about the family. And specifically, they're talking about the father. And they're talking about the father, how he smells sometimes when he's driving, and that the husband sometimes just rolls down the window so he doesn't notice it. But it's a very unique smell. It's a smell of just old. It just smells old. I believe that's what he says. Mm-hmm. And after the events of like the flood and everything, he goes back to go help them out because they're going to go and do a whole birthday party in the backyard for their son instead of going camping. And he's driving the wife around to grab groceries. And she recognizes the smell immediately. And it's not even subtle at all. She's like, she's grabbing her nose. She rolls down the window. She's gagging outside, like gagging to the most way a respectful woman could. And she's gagging. And like, it's obviously hurting the father's feelings. It's like, he's recognizing this kind of pain. And it makes you wonder, like, you know, have you ever, or have I ever in that mindset, like been in a place where I'm like, oh my gosh, what smells like old beets? And you find yourself like wondering where that smell comes from. And you ultimately don't know, but it may be the smell of somebody whose water got shut off the night before, or who's somebody who's like, who something happened to their home and he wasn't home. He wasn't home the night before. He had to be somewhere else. Like, it makes you wonder about the world around you. It makes you more aware of like the people that you reside here on this earth with, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you, am I thinking, am I digging too deep into this, or is this just like,
No, I had a very similar viewing experience. Besides wondering about the title of the movie, I thought a lot about, like, you know, my own impact.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I was sitting in a two-story house watching this movie. And I'm like, I'm doing so much better than a lot of people on this planet. And I don't know how I feel about that, you know?
Yeah. It almost gives you like a sense of like disgust that you're doing well.
Yeah.
It's weird, but it's like, oh, well, I'm fancy. I get to eat three meals a day.
Yeah.
Or like, oh, well, I'm fancy. We have jobs in this time of, you know, of a quarantine, you know, who am I? You know, kind of thing. It's like you recognize the simplest things that we normally take for granted as commonplace everyday things. And yet at the same time, we sometimes fail to look at the people who jump for joy when they grab that minimum wage job because they hadn't had a job in a few years. Mm-hmm. Or they are on their knees thanking the people who allow them to live within their house because they hadn't had their own bed and they've been sleeping on a couch for so much time. Like, you realize how much we've missed out on in taking notice of. And obviously this is not the official interpretation of the film. This is not, we didn't have a conversation with the director and like, but it's movies like this that make you realize, like, dang, like I live in a two-story house. You know, I have several laptops. I have a flat screen 4K TV. I have several game systems. I have all this recording equipment. We have a podcast. I eat three meals a day. There is always food in my fridge. You know, I have the family that's there. I have the people that I care about. I have friends that I can call on. I have a job that still employs me in this time. You know, I have a vehicle that's paid off and is mine, you know, and it's like, where at one point in time did I shift my focus on more of the things that I do have, or focus more on the things that I'm still lacking and not more so on the things that I do have, you know, on the everyday mindset. And I think this movie does that tremendously, because it gets to a point in this film where the father is like, he realizes this is as good as it's going to get for everybody, for my family, for me, and this isn't living. And I know we said we're gonna do spoilers, but the way the film wraps up, like, it's a whole hot mess.
Yeah, there's so much going on.
There is a ton, like, ultimately, the father gets to a point to where he's realized that he has just become a yes man for the sake of providing for the family, mm-hmm. and making ends meet and doing the short cons. And at the same time, you have the husband who is downstairs, whose wife has finally passed after she fell down those stairs after getting hit. Like, and he's coming up the stairs, and you have the Park family,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, the one that lives at the house.
They live there, yeah.
Who are oblivious to everything happening around them, and there's so many different elements of this film, and then even then the way this film wraps up, you're like, did I actually? Is that how the movie's going to end? Or is it just like some kind of fever dream? Like, am I watching? Like, is that really the way it's going to finish up? Because that'd be great. But then it doesn't. And I'm like, so
they propose this could happen. And then you get back. It's like,
it's
no.
And mind you, I'm not the biggest fan of La La Land, but it's kind of the way like La La Land ends, but not so obvious. Did you see La La Land?
No.
So in the end of La La Land, Ryan Gosling, spoiler alert, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. There's Emma Thompson, Emma Watts, Emma Stone, Emma.
All various ages.
So, Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling do not end up together.
Okay.
They go their own separate ways in life. She ends up marrying someone else. He ends up owning his own nightclub. And years down the road, years and years down the road, they end up at his nightclub and they have this visual connection. And there was this whole thing where like another version of their life together happens on screen and you see it and you're like, oh, is this the truth? But then you realize like, oh, that was just what could have.
Yeah.
And it ends. And in this one, you're left with like a really great conversation between the father, if you will, like this back and forth correspondence between the father and the son. And
isn't it one way?
Yes and no, but he
the father can talk out at that point.
Well, the father can talk out.
Yeah,
you're right. It is just it's a inner monologue that he has of a note that he wants to send to his father.
Yeah.
And it plays out this wonderful sequence, and you're like, okay. And then it, like, just when you're like at the peak of like, yes, this is, it snaps you back to reality, and you're like, well, wait, what's going to happen? And then it ends the movie. And so I have to say, like, one of the most powerful things this movie does is it gives you a sense of what really lies important with where we are in the world today. You could take the scholarly approach and be like, oh, the social commentary in this film is, you know, that, you know, the government spend way too much time in creating these definitive lines and society is just taken up to it. Whatever. Like, yeah, that's the obvious route. That's the more, yeah, whatever. But there's even deeper to that, you know? Like, you take a look at a film like this and you're like, in this movie, I can easily see myself playing a member of either family. You know, mm-hmm. I could see myself playing a member of the Park family. I could see myself being a member in the Kim family. Like, I can see myself playing on both sides. And it's like, as this movie plays out, you're wondering, where do I end up at the end of the film? You find yourself feeling in a bit of like a battle within your mind of who do I end up relating to when the chips are down the most. Mm-hmm. And I think that type of story, that type of element with this particular film is the end goal that the director sought to do, because the conversations that people are having nowadays, especially nowadays, in the midst of everything going on, in the midst of the coronavirus, in the midst of all the people in the entire world uncertain about what in the world is going to happen tomorrow and the next day. You know, people wake up and are worried about what will be announced today, what news is going to come about, and how will the world react. I think this movie leaves us with the answer to that in, we could either be the conniving, scheming, underhanded, ruthless family that seeks to make a buck and squeeze it out of whomever is around, and if need be, you know, be a parasite on those people. Or we could be the oblivious, everything's great, I'm doing fine, I'm not really too concerned about the other folk, I'm not really worried about them, these are workers, these are people that are just, you know, they do the work, and they work for me, and I will just benefit from their services, and show no concern for them. Mm-hmm. And either way you look at it, either way you shake a stick at it, that's pretty much the way most people have been. And you find yourself realizing you don't want to be either of those. You don't want to be the wealthy yet, you know, unconcerning family man or woman or person. Yet at the same time, you don't want to be the conniving, scheming, willing to put somebody else's health at risk so that you can earn a buck type of person either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting the way the movie leaves you and the way you find yourself like, well, shoot, nobody wins. In the end of all this, nobody wins. The people who have everything, they don't win. People who don't have anything, they don't win. So who does win?
Well,
please, by all means. That's an open-ended question because I don't even...
I'd say in this specific scenario, probably no one.
You think?
Yeah. But I don't know. There has to be like a way to balance, you know? Because I feel like really that's what this movie is kind of showcasing, is that there's a lack of balance
in the world today.
Yeah. Where it's like, you know, you're on like extremes on just like almost everything.
Yeah.
And that, you know, need to be brought to a balance where, you know, people can make money not off of the backs of other people. But I don't even know what that would look like.
Yeah, it's that's true. And I think going back to, I think the only true winner out of a lot of this is what I think that Scholar Stone represents. Because, so you take that rock that's given to the kid at the beginning of the film. The interesting thing about Scholar Stones is that they were always considered part of high class aesthetics, decoration. They were in homes of royalty. The collecting of these stones dates back thousands and thousands of years. People were always collecting them. And they always seem to be in the hands of scholars of like Confucius and things like that. So that's why they were eventually named Scholar Stones. And I think the stone acts as a key in terms of the stone is what gets you from point A to point B without having to sacrifice your morals or your ethics through education, through understanding, and through time and patience. Because the one thing that was evident about the kid is that he took the test constantly, but he never passed it.
Right.
The guy who did take the test and passed it was heading to America to do his schooling.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked more well-to-do about what he was going on, what was happening. Like, being wise and being smart, being scholarly, and if not through education, but making decisions based on that wisdom and that knowledge is what gets you from A to B.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a thought, because I mean, there had to have been a reason, and I know there's probably a couple hundred articles out there like, oh, I know the reason why that Scholar Stone was in the movie and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm pretty sure there's some, you know, blustery movie critic who's already figured it out and whatnot. But I feel like this makes sense to me. For me. I mean, it could be interpreted by whoever. Like I said, we didn't talk to the director firsthand, but I am saying it's interesting that this stone is prevalent from beginning to end. And I'd like to think the director wanted people to know one of the ways that is the key to making that transition, maybe not right now, but in time, is by educating yourself and finding a passion in learning or a passion in making those wise decisions. I don't know. I could be wrong.
See, I'd almost go with you on that. But then at the end of the movie, someone uses that stone to kill someone. So I don't know like how that would all fit together.
I don't.
Because then it's like, you know, use your education for good or for murder.
Yeah. I mean, if you use the your knowledge for the wrong reasons, i.e. to figure out that if you shave the peach fuzz off of a peach and you gently put it on someone's shoulder, you can cause a reaction. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different elements as to how, because the stone eventually made its way into that house.
Yeah.
And the intention of bringing the stone to that house was to commit some type of act of violence.
Yeah. Well, he was going to kill someone with that
thing. Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. The transition he took, making that, putting that stone from being a fixture in his own home to having it within that other house, seemed to warp the usage or the purpose of that stone, which it's a decoration. It's meant to adorn a desk or a wall or a shelf, not to be, you know, clonked into somebody's skull.
Yeah. That's what happened, though.
Yep. Well, wrapping up this wonderful and not melancholy conversation, let's go ahead and talk about how this film passes or fails in terms of our own merit, you know, and honestly, I think the film passes for me. This is definitely a movie that will be talked about for a long time from now. It'll be dissected even more, and it'll be like there'll be more Easter eggs, if you want to call them Easter eggs. I don't know, that Marvel's kind of watered down that term for what it is in movies, but like little subtle revelations in the film, in the ideology of the film or whatnot. I don't know. But it passes for me. It's definitely going to be a film that I will watch again once I can gather my wits. But until then, yeah. And in terms of monocles, I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5. The 0.5 is honestly because there were certain parts that were like, all right, that's cool, but not my whole thing. Like the whole couch scene with the parents. I was like, I think I could have done without that. But you know, it is good. It is all what it is. But yeah, 4.5 out of 5. It's a great film. So, what about you?
Remind me of that couch scene. That was just
that was awful. That was not a great scene.
Okay. Yeah, so no, this movie passes for me. It is just a shocker. I was not expecting this.
Yep.
I loved this movie. It was great. It wasn't like, even though we got like into a high level conversation, the movie isn't like so high level that no one's gonna get it.
Yeah, we're really digging deep into like to the small subtext, the subtext of what this movie's trying to say. But on the surface, this movie's just crazy. So yeah,
it's crazy. It's a crazy movie, and it's actually very understandable.
Yeah,
like, what it's talking about. It's like, but you'll like. When you're closer to the end, you'll get, oh, there's
other. You're like, oh,
yeah, oh. But for me, I will give this movie a 5 out of 5.
Wow.
Because I was highly impressed.
Wow. Okay, cool. It moved you that much, huh?
Yeah. That's nice.
Well, you should have seen it sooner. But that about wraps up.
Okay. Thank you.
That about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. Remember, you can catch all 200-plus episodes on our website at filmphilosophers.com. You can also check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmphilosophers and on our Twitter and Instagram at filmphilosophy101. Of course, we just want to let everybody know who's listening. We hope you're doing well. We hope you are keeping safe and keeping clean in this arduous time. And we do hope that when everything subsides, the sun will rise and we'll be able to go back to some sense of normalcy, you know? But until then, we are here. And please listen to us as much as you want. We give you that gift. So, but like I said, that wraps up another awesome episode. So, from all of us here at The Film Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.